There is hardly a court in San Francisco or Oakland where Tai Lung is not known and welcome as an excellent interpreter. All Chinatown knows her, and nearly all Chinatown loves her.
Welcome to Meridians.
Welcome to Meridians. I'm Charlie Noble. And in this episode, I'm talking about Tai Lung Schultz, Chinese immigration into the United States, as well as touching on some little unscripted unscripted conversation at the end here, more of a monologue about child labor and what the deal was with that in the early 20th century. So for now, let's go on. The structure of this episode is going to be, I'm going to kind of explain why Chinese immigration exploded in the late 1800s, then talk about Tai Lung Schultz's life, and then get into a bit about child labor. So on with the show. In 1848, there were believed to be only 325 Chinese Americans in the United States. By 1852, there were 25,000. By 1880, there were over 300,000 Chinese immigrants in the United States. Why did so many Chinese want to come to the United States during this time period? China was struggling in the 1840s, partly due to a series of events over the past several decades. In the late 1700s, China had been very successful in silver mining. This led to a trade imbalance with the British. The British wanted to introduce something to correct this trade imbalance. They looked to opium. British merchants started smuggling opium from Indian colonies into China. This led to an opium addiction, a crisis amongst the Chinese people. In response to this, the Qing government in China banned opium in 1796. Then later in 1839, the Chinese government destroyed large quantities of opium, triggering the first opium war with the British. After 3 years of war, China was defeated. They were forced to open 5 treaty ports to Western trade and to missionaries. This is also how Britain gained control of Hong Kong. The opium trade was also legalized. But then China had a new problem. The missionaries brought with them something that would lead to one of the bloodiest conflicts in human history. They brought the Bible. And to be fair, it wasn't the Bible itself that directly caused problems. It was the way one man interpreted the Bible, Huang Xiquan. He came to believe he was the brother of Jesus Christ. This led to the Taiping Rebellion, which started in 1850. This rebellion would result in 20 to 30 million deaths and cause significant destruction across China between 1850 and 1864. But back in 1849, merchants began arriving in Hong Kong from across the ocean with news of a land of opportunity in the United States. There were tales of Gam San, or Gold Mountain. Gam San became a way of referring to California or San Francisco specifically. The news of the gold rush had come to China. With word of opportunities across the sea and troubles in China, the population of Chinese immigrants in San Francisco exploded. By 1880, Chinese in California were a tenth of the population, many of them concentrated in San Francisco. The area they inhabited became known as Chinatown. This is where Tai Lung Schultz was born in 1887. She was the youngest of 5 sisters and 2 brothers. Her parents were immigrants from the Guangdong province of China. They lived in a cramped two-room apartment on Ross Alley in San Francisco's Chinatown. China, like many cultures of the time, had a custom of selling some of their children as servants to other families. It sounds insane to most modern people, but to many desperate families, it was considered a practical decision made out of necessity for the time. This was only temporary, as Lung's uncle stepped in and reversed the situation. While Tai Lung was lucky to have an uncle who cared for her, many other girls would not be so lucky. Besides the obvious psychological damage from being sold by your parents as a child, eventually many of these child servants would get sold again, and eventually, in the case of females, would end up as sex workers, or really, sex slaves. Later in her teen years, Tai Lung's sister was arranged to be married to a Montana man. When her sister ran away with her boyfriend, Tai Lung was designated to take her place. This is the moment that fate stepped in for Tai Lung. She was saved from this arranged marriage by Donaldina Cameron, a fierce woman who worked for a local Presbyterian mission and was a pioneer in the fight against slavery in Chinatown. She was known for wielding a fire axe during raids on brothels, and she rescued countless lives and stepped in when others wouldn't. And speaking of brothels, this is where many Chinese women would end up as sex slaves, either in exchange for servitude or possibly through being tracked from China directly into these brothels. Another thing to consider was that only around 4% of the Chinese Americans were women, so an enormous proportion of them were getting forced into sex work. This was what San Francisco's Chinatown was like at the turn of the 20th century. Tai Lung moved into a Presbyterian mission at the age of 14 and became Cameron's star pupil. During her time there, she converted to Christianity. This would also be where she would become proficient in the English language. Being bilingual would serve her greatly in her life. In 1910, the Angel Island Immigration Station opened. Tai Lung was getting to the age where she needed to support herself, so after 9 years of living and working at the Christian mission, she took the civil service examination and was hired to work as the assistant to the matron at the immigration station. She was the first Chinese American to pass the civil service examination. This was a big deal. She then became the first Chinese American to work for the U.S. government. She spent several years working at the immigration office, all the while she kept her eye out for women who might be in trouble. She gave many women help and direction when she could. Essentially, for a person trying to stop sex trafficking, she was in a perfect position to do so. She was bilingual, she understood what to look for, and she had connections to get these women help. But besides preventing them from being sex trafficked, she could help them navigate the new, wild, and strange city that San Francisco was. It was a lawless, wild place to be in the early 1900s for anyone. For many Chinese immigrants, it would have been terrifying. After passing the civil service examination, Tai Lung wasn't done with breaking barriers. In 1911, California became the sixth state to grant women the right to vote. This was a decade before the 19th Amendment was passed. She took her new right to vote seriously, stating, "I studied, I read about all your men who wish to be president, I learned about the new laws, I wanted to know what was right, not to act blindly." Being fluent in English, Tai Lung understood the voting process and the significance of her right to vote. She exercised this right at the first possible opportunity, the California presidential primary election. She voted at a polling station at Powell and Pacific Streets in San Francisco on May 19, 1912. Tai Lung is known for being the first Chinese American woman to vote in the United States. It's been stated that she may even be the first Chinese woman to vote ever. While she was working at Angel Island, she met Charles Schultz. This is the man that Tai Lung would marry. Unfortunately, their marriage would not be without consequences. Tai Lung was Chinese and Charles Schultz was a white American. At the time, even California had laws against interracial marriage. So-called miscegenation laws were put in place to prevent interracial marriage and sometimes also prohibited sex between races. It wouldn't be until 1967 that the Supreme Court ruled in Loving v. Virginia that all states' anti-miscegenation laws were unconstitutional. Both of their families disapproved of their marriage. The government disapproved of their marriage. But love is love, and Tai Lung Schultz wouldn't be told what to do. The couple married in Washington State, one of the few states where it was legal. Their marriage then resulted in both Tai Lung and Charles being fired from their jobs at Angel Island. They would remain married and have four children together, living on the outskirts of Chinatown. Tai Lung continued to help her community in a less official capacity. For several years, Tai Lung and her husband struggled to find steady work due to discrimination against them. She did manage to find work as a bookkeeper at the San Francisco Chinese Hospital for a while and other various places where she could find work. But in 1926, Tai Lung Schultz would be employed as a PBX switchboard operator connecting thousands of people across Chinatown. She would excel at this job, having to speak in two or three different Chinese dialects to assist callers effectively. She wouldn't just connect calls, though. She was an asset to the community. She would help locals get in touch with lawyers, courts, and immigration services, again, showing her heart of gold and love for her community. She would work as a switchboard operator for the next 20 years. Then in a comeback moment in 1946, she was hired again by the Immigration Service. The War Brides Act of 1945 made for the allowance of spouses and children of World War II soldiers to immigrate to the United States. This surge of immigration made translators like Tai Lung invaluable. Tai Lung Schultz lived in San Francisco until she died in 1972. She was 84 years old. She broke racial barriers, stood for equal rights with her husband, and projected her right as a woman to vote. The obvious lesson of her life was to live for others. It's so simple, yet so easy to overlook. Many people do many things to try and express themselves or bring their life significance through self-aggrandizement, power, greed, or lust. Tai Lung isn't remembered for any of these things. She's remembered for what she did for her community. Her mentor, Donaldina Cameron, put it this way. There is hardly a court in San Francisco or Oakland where Tai Lung is not known and welcome as an excellent interpreter. All Chinatown knows her, and nearly all Chinatown loves her. So, now I want to talk a little bit about child labor in the early 20th century, late 19th century, and what the heck is going on there? Who's selling their kids? It sounds like they're selling their kids. They kind of were. That's really what it was. If you're forcing your kid to work, it's child labor. It's the way it is here, though, is why this happened was you've got people in poverty, and they've basically got these children who they could work in their mind, and they could be bringing income in for the family, you know, in any way they could. Remember, this is a time when there's no minimum wages, there's no labor laws. It's gritty. People are trying to survive, do whatever they can to feed their families. So from about the time when you're upright, you better start supporting the family and helping out around the house. And so they'd send these childs off to be indentured to others. And this would be a way for these children to contribute to family budgets. Well, then there's also another aspect to this. there's the Industrial Revolution that's rapidly demanding labor. It needs more cheap labor. And supply and demand sort of went out here. And children were even preferred by factory owners due to their lower wage and perceived advantages in certain tasks. You know, they could get in and do things and not complain. You know, I'm sure plenty of kids complained. But then also there's this there's a huge orphan crisis in this time. And you've got these workhouses and orphanages that would actually sell these children as pauper apprentices, we'll put that in quotes, to factories and households to work. And, you know, a lot of these kids are minorities, but then there's plenty of kids of all races, creeds, all over. Probably the uniting factor would be poverty among these children. But then the practice of child labor, it was just accepted and encouraged by legal systems because, you know, in the name of progress, I guess. I don't know. But there was also a lack of educational opportunities at the time. These kids they weren't going to go to school. There wasn't schools for them to go to. So they would need to do something. So their family said, well, we're going to indenture them to some other person who will give us some money. And then, oh, look, we have one less mouth to feed and we've got money coming in. So it's that simple. It's their economic needs, I guess. And they were also being exploited, of course. These are vulnerable populations. There's a language barrier. They don't know any rights that they have. Even if they did have them, they probably weren't going to be able to exercise those rights. And very few people were speaking on their behalf. So, and if you've ever heard of the book The Jungle by Upton Sinclair, it was published in 1906, and it actually exposed this harsh reality of child labor. It kind of made people confront this problem and said, look at this. This is ridiculous. It's easy when you don't see it to ignore it, right? So, I mean, that's why open and independent journalism is so important, because it can expose just awful things that people are doing behind closed doors. But so the book actually highlighted these issues. So children were forced to help in support. For example, there was a 13-year-old Stanislavus who had to work in a large canning factory instead of attending school. Could you imagine being a kid and just being forced to work in a canning factory all day? Just awful. And then it was dangerous, unsanitary. They'd be working in hazardous environments. They're exposed to chemicals, extreme temperatures. It's ridiculous even to consider these days. And of course the wage thing, of course, like I said, and they were working long hours as well. They'd earn like 5 cents. This example of Stanislavus worked for 5 cents an hour for his labor. I mean, 5 cents an hour. So like 10 hours a day, he's made 50 cents a day, but don't worry. He's working more than 10 hours a day. He's working 12, 15. I mean, just these kids, this is not something children should be doing. This is not what you think about when you think of the Industrial Revolution. You think it's this great, wonderful, wow, we're modernizing. And it's like off the backs of somebody. The more you look at history, the more you see that so much progress was made at the expense of somebody else. Whereas you start to wonder, should we have traded this rapid progress for maybe a little bit more cultural progress instead? I mean, having cars and buildings and modern things is great, but the costs, I don't know if they were worth it. So that's kind of how this child labor thing happened in San Francisco. I mean, it just blows my mind that this was ever a thing. But, you know, it's not like this suddenly happened in the late 1900s. This is a continuation of different you know, different classes and ethnic groups have different needs. They go through different times in their culture where they're desperate, where they're exploited, where there's revolutions, you know, all throughout human history. And this isn't something that just exploded, this child labor, but the way that it was done, the gritty, like, building, and it's just the unnaturalness of it, I guess, is what's so jarring. And if you look it up, you look up pictures online of children that have these, like, mangled hands. I've seen pictures of little children. I mean, we're talking like 8 years old, and their hands look like a 60-year-old man's because they've been working such long hours doing such tedious labor. Because a lot of times, because of their small hands, they would be doing things that only somebody with small hands could do, tedious work, and it would, you know, give them all kinds of problems. It's just, and they had no say in this matter. Remember, these are children. These are children being forced to work by their parents, who probably felt like they had no other choice. It's hard to put, you know, sit here and judge people, but when your whole family is starving, is it so unjust to send one of them off who's capable-ish to work? I don't know. It's the problem with history. It's really hard to judge, and it's kind of obnoxious to sit here and judge people from the past without fully understanding the situation they were in. So, but anyway, that's the episode for today. I'm going to probably head to China and talk about those opium wars in a lot more detail in the next episode. It's, once again, the British just took a giant shit all over the planet Earth for about 300 years, it feels like. And we're all still dealing with the consequences of that. And I know it wasn't just the British, obviously the United States and other European countries, countries all over the world have exploited each other. But man, Britain sure seemed to have quite the impact throughout the world. But we'll get into that, the Opium Wars specifically, and talk about that in the next episode. But for now, thanks for listening. I'm Charlie Noble. This has been Meridians. We'll see you next time.